NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our guest today, David Folkenflik, says every major institution in society requires scrutiny, whether government, business, religion, and especially, in his case, the media. Folkenflik is NPR's media reporter, and he says in that role, he's covering some powerful players, given journalism's ability to influence, enlighten, reveal, intimidate, and even exploit. He's also tracking an increasingly chaotic media landscape. Folkenflik calls it bedlam and even anarchy, where anyone today can be considered a reporter, a new entrant like WikiLeaks, Gawker, local blogs, even someone tweeting or posting on Facebook or YouTube, all contributing to the mass of information out there. Mainline news organizations have struggled to adapt, and Folkenflik's told their stories of failure and triumph. But in addition to these broader narratives about the upheaval and adaptation of the media sector, Folkenflik has also reported on when news organizations have erred. And that includes the mishaps of his own employer, National Public Radio, which has just emerged from a period of scandal and negative headlines. Today in The Exchange, David Folkenflik is here. He spoke at an NHPR event in Manchester last night and joins us this morning. And we'll take your calls, too. The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. And David, welcome to New Hampshire and welcome to The Exchange.
Hey, thanks so much. It's great to be here in studio.
Well, at the event last night, you said every year or year and a half or so, you try to pull your head out of the daily news, the daily headlines, and look at the big picture. And back in 2009, David, you said you started thinking about trust. What made you start thinking about this, and what did you find out in terms of people and their trust or mistrust of the media?
There you go again, trying to hold me accountable for what I actually say. I thought back, I guess it was about 18 months ago, better part of 2 years ago, the question of trust was one that kept coming up, and it surfaced in different ways. It surfaced in a poll by the Pew Research Center and the Project for Excellence in Journalism. It surfaced which showed trust in journalism to be at pretty much an all-time low. Then again, as you alluded to in your introduction, trust in major institutions, by and large, are pretty low. If you look at institutions of finance, halls of government, whether people trust major religious institutions or sports stars or others to be doing the right thing, to be living honestly, to be looking out for others. And the media is by no means exempt from that. And I decided to do that in a couple of ways. And one of the ways I did that was I went down to Atlanta and I did a story for NPR about Atlanta's a microcosm of the media landscape. After all, it's a place that has hyper-local new blogs, players on the scene. It's got the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, one of the nation's leading titles as a regional newspaper. And it also has CNN and CNN International, which is a news organization of some real reporting muscle across the globe. And I talked to executives and leaders and editors at each to say, how do you think about trust? But I also talked to people in the community, people in the suburbs, people downtown, people from different sectors of life.
You just went out to people on the street.
Sure.
What do you think about – hi, I'm David Folkenflik. What do you think about trust in the media?
Me and a microphone. One of the interesting things I found was that people said when asked that, well, the media is biased and here's why. And the thing that struck me about that was I hadn't asked about bias. I'd asked about, you know, trust. And it seemed to me reflective of this tension about people are wondering where we're coming from. There's a tension between the, I think, the old line journalistic value of objectivity, never perfectly attainable, but always a goal and an aspiration, the standard that you aspire to. And the idea is that you carry no brief for anyone. The idea is that you're there as a reporter to reflect where the facts take you. And as a news organization, maybe on your editorial pages, you might offer some point of view, some conclusions. But otherwise, writ large in your news coverage throughout the different sections or on the air at places like NHPR, you're going to present people the news in the context so they can make up decisions for themselves. Well, there's a new value, I think, fueled by technology, the internet, what's possible online. And that's of transparency. And the idea is we're going to reveal where we're coming from. Publications like Mother Jones or Ms. Magazine or the National Review or the Weekly Standard have been doing this for years and decades in some cases.
And had some success with that.
And had perfect success and have played a constructive role even in the older school media ecosystem. But this value of transparency is the notion of if we reveal where we're coming from and our point of view, you will better be able to evaluate how we look at these things. One way to think about this is a good movie critic. There's a guy named Stephen Hunter, used to be a movie critic for The Washington Post. Before that was a colleague of mine at the Baltimore Sun. And I didn't agree with his sensibility on some things. He likes movies that are more gory and graphic than I do. But I knew where he was coming from. He was straight up about the kinds of things that he valued. And so you could always use him as a reliable barometer, very insightful critic, I thought, of how well-made movies were, how intelligently they were made. The movie The American President, made by a liberal writer Aaron Sorkin and the director Rob Reiner, he said, look, I don't love the politics of this movie. He's a more conservative guy on that. He said, but this is a really well-made example of what it is. And again, in that sense, he was being transparent. Similarly, if you look at websites that have had some influence, Talking Points Memo, TPM, is clearly a liberal outlet. If you look at online, there are a bunch of actors in both conservative, liberal, whatever point of view, but they're very clear and upfront about where they're coming from. And some people have found that more useful. Some people trust that more. And so it seemed to me a time to explore those kinds of issues.
Well, and you called it a new value in the emerging media landscape. But as I understand just from reading history, David, it's also an old value. I mean, 150 or so years ago, you had the yellow journalism and you had newspapers trumpeting, the Federalists or the Whigs or whatever.
Well, think of Foster's Daily Democrat here in New Hampshire. It didn't get that by chance. It clearly was a partisan force for the Democrats many, many, many decades ago, probably in the 19th century, although I don't claim to be an expert on New Hampshire press lore. But the notion was that there were affiliations. And there was, at that time, the editorial page's sensibilities really were the engines driving the papers. Nowadays, it has been seen that it's more the news pages. And that evolved as a business model more than anything else. When there were a dozen newspapers in major cities or a half dozen in smaller cities, each of them had to define a niche.
And you had a choice as a reader.
As newspapers consolidated, the business models changed on that. Newspapers wanted to appeal to the greatest number of people. Similarly, the Associated Press, which helped to set the bar for how people thought about journalistic standards in this country, came about as a cooperative of newspapers. And it was rigorously nonpartisan, nonsectarian, in part because it wanted to serve the greatest number of clients. So interestingly, commercial interests drove what became a value of objectivity and independence from any political brief.
And are you saying now, David, that commercial interests are again dictating a return to that other standard of we're the liberal paper, we're the conservative paper, we're the liberal TV station or radio station or whatever? Are you saying commercial values are returning the business back to that model?
Well, I can answer that in two different ways, one of which is that I think if you look at cable news and the emergence of Fox News in 1996 came at really the same time that the internet and the web came into its own, same year. Roger Ailes hit pretty much pitch perfectly a niche of an audience, what turned out to be the largest cable niche in news, that felt it was not being served by the mainstream media, that felt that the mainstream media was not taking care of their interests, that it was ignoring or slighting the kinds of stories that they found of value. And he really hit that perfectly. And he incorporated that into its DNA of Fox. So the part of the brilliance of Fox is that it's a self-perpetuating cycle because its stories very much center around the idea of a sense of aggrievement towards the rest of the media. If you look at what MSNBC is trying to do to try to capture that same energy and passion that viewers for Fox have on the left, you can see that that differentiation is occurring in cable as well. The second way I'd answer that is that I think that we're kind of in a patchwork age where in different markets and different moments, different people are deciding things. In the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's case, when I did that story about trust in Atlanta, I talked to Julia Wallace, then the top editor of the newspaper. They decided to get rid of its editorial page as having a strong point of view.
Really?
They would simply really balance things. They wanted editorials to get – they didn't entirely do away with it, but they largely did – get out of the business of telling people what to think and setting the agenda and more say we're going to continue to focus on our enterprise reporting, our investigative work, and we're going to have balanced views on the opinion pages so that there are different voices heard. We won't be setting that. Now, one of the reasons that this is so striking to me is that if you know the history of the civil rights movement in this country, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution is the inheritor of a newspaper that had carried the torch for civil rights equality in Atlanta and what became the New South. It took courageous stands against segregationists. It went after Lester Maddox, who was himself a segregationist governor of some vitriolic rhetoric who tried to push back against certain kinds of federal civil rights laws. And its editorial pages were a place for that championing to occur, while its news coverage, its reporters often risked their own personal safety to report on the conflict itself. For the Journal Constitution to decide it is not in our business interests to alienate our more conservative suburban readership base, so we want to get away from this liberal tradition on its editorial pages, is a way of saying we think we need to double down on the idea of being an honest broker and an independent one, an objective one, and to be seen doing so.
Wow. Well, USA Today also does what you talk about. They have two editorials, Our View, and then below it they have Another View from a prominent thinker or politician or something. And given my sensibility as a reporter, I enjoy that. I like seeing, okay, this is what USA Today's editorial board thinks, and this is what someone else who's also knowledgeable thinks. But I wonder, David, if everybody appreciates that, or if a lot of the public would rather just, you know, hear those views that conform with theirs. They'd rather just happily sit in their echo chambers.
Well, one of the things I think that the modern media age has shown is that we have to, as consumers and as citizens, take more ownership and responsibility for what we consume in the news and where we find our information and our context, and that that can't be done with any single outlet, even, dare I say it, NPR and an HBR or any single newspaper. So I think it's up to us to have a varied diet, as we like to say.
All right. We'll talk about more after a short break. On that point, David, because, boy, if you want a varied diet, there's a lot of variety out there these days, a very chaotic new media landscape. We'll start taking your calls, too, at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Keep it right here.
Support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from UR members and from Southern New Hampshire Medical Center and Foundation Medical Partners, working together to design healthcare around you where you live and work, online at snhhs.org. And Milne Travel American Express, nearly 100 local travel professionals in 10 locations across 4 states. Whether planning a trip of a lifetime or enjoying a lifetime of travel, Milne is there to help. More with NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik on The Exchange on NHPR, then at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, efforts to address the prescription drug shortage. New Hampshire weather today, mostly sunny with high temperatures, 49 to 54 degrees. Tonight, partly cloudy and chilly, lows from 25 in the North Country, 25 to 30 in the Lakes region and Connecticut River Valley area, and 30 to 35 degrees in southern parts of New Hampshire. Tomorrow, a mix of sunshine and clouds with high temperatures, 55 to 60. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with NPR media reporter David Folkenflik about the future of the news business and his own work covering an increasingly chaotic media landscape. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. As David talks about this idea of trust of the media, or lack thereof, what are your thoughts? Are there any sources that you trust? Do you distrust all sources but try to consume, as he says, from a variety of news sources? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. And David, before we go to the phones, let's talk about that. I mean, you know, you're a media correspondent, and probably 10 or 15 years ago, that was pretty easy. You covered the TV stations and the newspapers and the radio stations, and boom, you were done. Today, you could literally stay up 24 hours a day trying to cover all that's media out there. It's gotten pretty chaotic.
It's gotten chaotic, and the nature of the beat, at least in the way that it interests me, has changed. I've been doing this one way or another for, gosh, over 11 years now. First as the media reporter and critic of the Baltimore Sun, and then for the last 7 years for NPR. You know, the beat was often handled as kind of an offshoot of celebrity news. You sort of see, okay, well, which anchor is making how much money? Where are their ratings? Is it neck and neck like some sort of horse race? Where's the money? And I think it's so much more complex and interesting than that. I think there's so many new players. The barriers to entry have lowered so that smart people with a small shot but a big idea can come along and reshape how we think about things. If you think about Politico, there were a couple of guys from the Washington Post, Jim Vandehei, an energetic reporter, John F. Harris, a former reporter and then editor, who said, you know, we want to really obsess about politics. We want to make it a pure drip, a centrifuge that distills all things political, and we want to do that. And they didn't find that they were able to do that at the Washington Post, a place where, federal politics is its bread and butter. It's how it makes its money. It serves. It's a company town, and it's the local paper in the company town, as well as a paper with, real global reporting muscle as well. And so they just went out and got some seed money and did it. And they really have built up something amazing. I think you can take issue on how they cover certain things. I think that they are focused at times on the incremental. They often report on politics almost in the absence of the effects of policy that is decided.
Oh, it's very much the political horse race and he said, she said.
But they have provided coverage that people all over the country can turn to, as their own newspapers and news organizations have often cut back on their political coverage and still get an insider's feel for how things are playing out in Washington. If that's your bag, you can get it
right,
and you can read it for free. That was an idea. They got some real money backing for it, but it was just two guys who said, we want to do something here.
Well, and even though a lot of people have kind of wrung their hands and said there's been a demise of traditional media and no one is fact-checking anymore and so forth, and those critiques may all be true, but I've gotten the feeling from you, David, that you don't necessarily think this chaos, again, using your words, is bad.
Bedlam. bad is there is no way to characterize all that's occurring. There is a lot happening, and there's a lot of creation even as there's been a lot of destruction. I can lament what is lost. You know, I worked at the Baltimore Sun. At its peak, it had, call it 408, 410 people in the newsroom, that is journalists. It was a paper that the day I walked in, I believe it had 9 foreign correspondents and 15 people in its Washington bureau. And for, a news organization serving, call it the 24th largest city in the country, that was a pretty impressive thing. The economics don't support that anymore, and terrible choices by the corporate owners of the Baltimore Sun, first the Tribune Company and then the Sam Zell, who took over the Tribune Company and layered it with $13 billion of debt. You know, that had nothing to do with the news organization but everything to do with its finances. Well, the Sun is down to, as I understand it, 220 to 240 journalists, so a little over half of what it was. It's a thinner paper. It's a much less ambitious newspaper. There are no foreign bureaus. I believe there's one person writing some stuff from Washington. And it can't do all it did. And I can lament that constriction of ambition, that winnowing of its reach, has driven a lot of incredibly good people away from it. And although there are some dedicated people doing very good work every day, and although the Sun remains the largest newspaper in the state of Maryland, news organization, newsroom in the state of Maryland by far, it is not doing all that it could. But there are a lot of very interesting innovations that just weren't available. You know, I'm from Southern California. Every day I can check on how the Angels do during the baseball season, and I'm sorry, Red Sox Nation, but I can do that online for free instantly at a moment's impulse. You can find news from all over. I read British newspapers. I very laboriously occasionally read French newspapers. You can find news from all over that satiate your interests and your appetite of all kinds. And so that's very exciting. And I think that it's hard to say this is bad. I think it is what it is, and we have to sort of recognize, embrace the strengths, figure out ways to compensate for the shortcomings and the shortfalls and the mistakes that have been made in the past.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. We want your observations of the business of media that David Folkenflik covers. In a way, the media has become more of a conglomerate. Things have been pulling together bigger media companies. And in other ways, with Twitter and blogs and online news sources, it's become more fractured. We want your thoughts on that. Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And looking at your job then, David, as a media correspondent, and certainly there's much more media for you to cover, as we've been saying, do blogs and tweets and, you know, other online sources like Politico, especially if they want to be considered quote-unquote media, do they get the same scrutiny from you and other media correspondents?
I mean, I think part of it depends on what they're contributing to the public conversation. So, you know, if you decide to take to Twitter and suddenly you have a major following, you can move the conversation a little bit by raising intelligent and pointed questions. You can – I find – that Facebook seems to me to be more influential when you make postings for people who want certain kinds of activism, to rally certain kinds of political support. But that said, news organizations are finding Facebook to be a channel of its own. So I believe NPR has well over a million people who have clicked like on NPR, and that means its stories and its postings are being streamed and sent out to over a million people every time one of our social media folks decides to put it up. That's a new channel and outlet to reach people. Scott Simon, if I'm not mistaken, has more, you know, our host of our own Weekend Edition Saturday, has more than a million followers on Twitter. So we learn about his culinary interests, his sporting interests. We learn about his daughter's Halloween costumes. But we also learn if he has a funny take on the news or he's posting a story done by someone else, he can draw our attention to that. It's an amazing new outlet that's being harnessed by individuals and institutions. When people contribute to the public discussion, it becomes part of the media. The great thing about the U.S. is you don't need to be licensed to be a journalist. You decide that you want to contribute to the conversation. The interesting thing about the current age is you don't even necessarily consciously have to decide you're contributing to the media ecosystem. If you're just, tweeting to friends or other actors, suddenly you get caught up in it. And again, I think that when there's an influence on public discussion, when there's influence on public events, then sure, it can be part of my portfolio.
It gets on your radar and you say, okay, this is important. Obviously, you can't possibly cover every blogger that's out there or every person of note that's tweeting or person not of note that's tweeting, just your average Joe or Jane. But once it reaches the point where it's having an influence on the public or on policy, you start to take notice. Who is this? What are they doing?
Yeah, and it may be that you're just taking notice for a moment, mm-hmm. and that's the moment, a snapshot in time that it's worth to explore that. But I very much see what happens in the social media space as part of what I need to keep an eye out for. Look, I mean, people always thought that I watched every TV show and every news broadcast anyway, and you can't live
you
life
like
that.
You only have one
like
set
that.
Of eyeballs.
So it's not as though I could find anything. The nice thing is in today's media system, things find you. So the next morning, if there's a clip that is particularly compelling or a clip that's particularly controversial from cable news or from network news or something from one of our member stations or something that was reported by the Des Moines Register, whatever it is, we're all multi-platform broadcasters one way or another this day and age. Even newspapers are putting video clips online and vice versa. And it finds you because somebody – the reason I'm following 500 people on Twitter, which is maybe a little high – is that I find those people ultimately lead me to interesting places, and it helps me in my job every day.
Well, speaking of interesting places, let's go to our listeners and see what they have to say. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. The email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And from Northampton, Guy is up first. Hi, Guy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. I very much support what David has been saying about the richness of the media being a wonderful thing. I do confess I'm a bit of a media junkie, and I enjoy having such a diversity of outlets. I'd add to his comments about consuming the international media. It's very interesting, for example, to sometimes look at Al Jazeera for their take on the international perspective. And it's very refreshing to have that contrast sometimes to the domestic U.S. media. And the other thing that I'd add is that I also find that even people like, for example, Jon Stewart, who's a comedian, but in effect a political commentator on the left, or media bloggers like, oddities like Iowa Hawk, who's a blogger, conservative blogger, also add a lot of both entertainment and richness to perspectives on, you know, opinion, etc. So, you know, as a fairly independent, you know, political person, I find it both entertaining and very enlightening to have this richness. So thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Guy. What do you think, David? And then I have a question for you actually about the British media, which is different from ours. But go ahead.
Well, I thank you for the call, Guy, and I very much take your point. I mean, one of the interesting things is that they're not only new players, but they're those new players often have new reach. So Al Jazeera, obviously, you know, sponsored by the Emir of Qatar, has now an international reach and an English language broadcasting element. It has not been able to be find carriage in a lot of cable providers around the country because of the controversy that surrounded it after our invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, and particularly surrounding the idea that somehow it had links to bin Laden and al-Qaeda because it carried videotapes from him in those early years. That said, I mean, the hostility of Bush administration officials, although some of them would go on Al Jazeera, has been transformed. I've just edited a book called Page One, Inside the New York Times and the Future of Journalism. It includes a lot of chapters and contributors of players in different places in the media ecosystem. One of the things I included was a testimony by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton from earlier this year before a Senate panel. And she was talking about how valuable Al Jazeera was and how frustrating it was that American reporting and even American intelligence wasn't always to tell her able to tell her what was happening during the uprisings of the Arab Spring, and that she turned to Al Jazeera for reliable information. And I found, and I was watching at that time fairly closely, that Al Jazeera, days ahead of its American peers and competitors, was able to suss out what was occurring, especially in Egypt and then Tunisia in earlier days. It took a little while for American outlets. CNN does have reporting knowledge and muscle there, but it took a while for American outlets to get there, but also to realize that American officials who were fumbling towards a response towards regimes that, although often autocratic, had been sympathetic to our own and allied with our strategic interests, were not necessarily responding in a way that was concordant with the desires of their citizens, and that these were not simply stirred up by Muslim Brotherhood or other shadowy groups with which we might take some exception, but rather that there was some spontaneity to the protests there. And so Al Jazeera actually was valuable, and its web traffic, a way to get around its lack of carriage on cable and satellite television, its web traffic went up something like 25 times, you know, 2,500%. And I think that was a testament to people's hunger for additional sources of information.
You know, Guy's call reminds me, David, of something you said last night about your trip to Britain recently and how the news business there is kind of a mirror image of ours, whereas here we have, you know, the Washington Post or the LA Times or San Francisco Chronicle, you know, saying we are objective and we're going to give you both sides and we're going to give it to you straight. You say in Britain, they say, no, we are the conservative paper or we are the liberal paper. Talk about how different that is to what we see here.
Sure.
The benefits of that system.
I went a little less than a year ago to London. More recently, I was there for some of the Murdoch issues. But I went there last winter to explore this tension between transparency, where we're coming from, and objectivity. And they have an inversion of the American system, as you suggest. The broadcasters there, led by the BBC, have this notion of we are going to play it straight. We are going to give you facts. We will do investigative stuff, but we're also not going to carry a brief for anyone. Sky News, which is controlled by Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, it's actually part of B Sky B, in which the Murdoch family leads News Corp's 40% stake in B Sky B. In any event, Sky News actually, instead of being like Fox News in Britain and being highly opinionated in its most highly rated shows, is also fairly straight down the middle. It's a little brasher. It's a little more edgy than the BBC. But basically, they're trying to report it down the middle. It's the newspapers that are brawling and fratricidal, and they've established market niches where you might be the more upper scale conservative paper like the Telegraph or the more down market liberal paper, the Daily Mirror, which you know, Piers Morgan had a hand in back in the day in running. And these are outlets that have decided that for decades that they were going to differentiate themselves a little bit like we see the differentiation between Fox News and MSNBC now. Now, if you think about the peculiarity of the UK, you know, London is sort of Hollywood and New York and Washington all in the same town. And so when they have a national capital that can have trucks out to most parts of the country within, call it, 3 hours to take those newspapers, the niche is more about how you position yourself and less about geography.
I see. So LA Times is always going to dominate in Southern California because it's about Southern California.
Right.
There you can take your newspaper and be somewhere in a matter of hours.
That's right. And so that's how they differentiate themselves. And, you know, people I talk to there say, well, it's ridiculous that, you know, you think the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times doesn't have a point of view. Of course it does. Our guys are honest about it. And in so being, they make different story selections. They may make different story emphases, but you can also evaluate them, as we were talking before. And it was a very interesting system. You know, I will say that I think that standards for American reporting are higher. I think that there is a sense that it's a more professional and a less roguish operation. I can attest to the fact that I've had times that stories I've written have had quotes lifted without any attribution and show up a few days later in British newspapers. And you don't find that as much here in the American press. So, you know, it does have an effect on standards if the idea is, well, we may be slightly roguish, but you can see through it. And I think some of that played out in the scandals we've seen of the recent months.
I love that word, roguish, when it comes to newspaper reporters. You're right. That's not often attributed to American reporters at the New York Times or NPR. Let's take another call. This is Carl in Concord. Hi, Carl. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you today?
Fine. Go ahead.
All right. What I'd like to do is maybe posit an opinion. As a consumer of news, what I'd like to see is a star system, 5 stars, meaning that it's been the story's been properly vetted by grown-ups, and you may even find some of their sources. You could go online and find some of their sources. 3 stars would be a little bit more, a little bit less reliable, and 1 star would be just an assertion, just gossip, a whisper in someone's ear. What do you think?
Well, who would assign the stars, Carl?
Well, it would be kind of self-assigning, maybe a national standard or international standard.
Just
along
like,
those lines.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Carl. What do you think? Just like the hotel system or just like these online rating sources where consumers make comments, a star rating system for the news or news business?
I have a feeling that most news businesses would say we're all 5 stars, you know, and leave it at that. What I would say is that, you know, readers and listeners and viewers like Carl get to take it upon themselves. And one of the ways news organizations can earn your trust is to be transparent. Perhaps not about ideology, if that's not the way they do it, but about how they did their reporting. Help you find links to sources, help lay out where things are, rely less on anonymous or unnamed sources. And that's one way people can earn a lot of stars with listeners and viewers.
Well, and Carl, it's an interesting idea. And, you know, another way they do it is they leave their opinions on the blogs, on the comment pages after a story. I want to talk to you about that after a break, David. And we'll keep taking your calls, so stay with us.
The Tupelo Public Radio Project brings nationally renowned musicians to a New England stage. I'm Kate McNally. Join me for the first of this live concert series featuring the talents of Katie Curtis.
If I make a mark in time, I can't say the mark is mine. I'm only the underline.
Catch Katie Curtis live on stage at the Tupelo Music Hall in White River Junction, Vermont. The fun starts at 8 on November 11th. Get your tickets at nhpr.org.
Support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from UR members and from Kimball Union Academy, a co-educational boarding and day school, inspiring excellence in students grades 9 through 12 with an open house this Saturday in Meriden, New Hampshire, KUA.org. And Capital Center for the Arts in Concord, presenting in concert singer-songwriter-guitarist Annie DeFranco, Sunday, November 13th at 7:30. Tickets at ccanh.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, why the United States gets failing grades on preventing child abuse, especially compared to other industrialized nations. Email us before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today we're sitting down with David Folkenflik. He's NPR's media correspondent. He did an event with NHPR last night in Manchester and joins us today to look at the state of our media, the changing landscape. Our number for you to join us is 1-800-848-9222. 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email us, exchange@nhpr.org. And, you know, David, we've been talking high concept this hour about, you know, the changing landscape and the role of new media and how old media has adapted, the issue of public trust or lack thereof. But let's get down to something that dominated your life for the past year, practically. And you know where I'm going with this, David. The headline that NPR fired commentator Juan Williams. Now, you said it was more that his contract was not renewed. Now, it's not your job, David, to say, obviously, this was right, this is wrong. But how do you feel that affected the public trust, the public image of NPR?
Well, first, obviously, as you suggest, it's important to say I don't speak for NPR management. I'm the guy who, for better or worse, has been charged with covering this, and it's meant covering colleagues and friends and bosses and the like, and that, you know, it can be an uncomfortable position, but it's important for us to do it as completely, with as much context as possible, and as transparently as possible. I think that's how we earn trust. To clarify, Juan Williams' contract was terminated early.
I see. So he not renewed is not correct.
No, I mean, that was, in fact, one of the questions raised by internal critics of how it was handled, and there were many, was, you know, why not let his contract elapse in the spring? Now, he takes offense even at that, as you may recall. He was terminated. His termination was precipitated by comments he had made supporting Bill O'Reilly on Fox News when O'Reilly said, you know, Muslims cause terrorism, you know, why should I be embarrassed for having said that? You know, I'm not saying all Muslims, and, you know, flap ensued. He was supportive while saying people should not be judged on their faith or discriminated against on the basis of their faith. The Juan's termination triggered months of political controversy, but it also occurred in the days leading up to the 2010 elections. And lawmakers on the conservative side and the Republican leadership decided to incorporate that as part of their rhetoric to a greater degree than they had before. It's obviously come up. Public funding for public broadcasting has come up time and again over the past, call it, 15 years or so. But, you know, Tea Party and conservative elements of the new Congress have made that seemingly at least rhetorical priority. And that was not a good place for NPR to be in. Its member stations rely much more heavily on public support than NPR itself does. NPR receives, call it, between $1 and $2 million a year directly from federal agencies and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. But member stations receive on average 10% of their funding. And that's a significant hole. And so stations felt that that the network had acted in a way that caused a lot of controversy. The way I tried to deal with it as a reporter was to report on it. And it wasn't always comfortable, as I said.
You got put aside in a separate unit, you said.
Well, not put aside,
but you were really detached from the institution so that you could cover this fairly.
Yeah, I mean, it was more a virtual detachment than anything else. But my editor and a senior editor at NPR were sort of separated out so that nobody who had any involvement with the decision to terminate Juan's contract was involved in any way in deciding the coverage of the controversy that ensued. We did stories that I'm sure that Juan and some of his fans didn't love. We did stories that discomfited at times leadership of NPR that they didn't – that they would wish was presented in a different way. But to NPR's great credit, it never tried to shut down or even put its thumb on the scales. It let me and my editors do our business and try to report as thoroughly as possible. At times we were accused of doing too much, but my feeling was that our listeners were probably overly interested compared to the general public. And I think NPR showed its values and its commitment to full ventilation and coverage of issues of import and controversy, even when it affected the institution itself.
Yeah, I remember hearing the All Things Considered hosts reading the introductions to your stories during that time. I remember thinking, okay, how is he going to do this? You know, because it is so hard. You're part of the organization. The people you're reporting on are friends, colleagues, mentors, people who helped you when you were new in the business. It must have been a very difficult line for you to walk.
It was. And, you know, I simply had to do it. I said I didn't often have to explain it explicitly to the people about whom I was reporting. You know, they understand, they get the game. They're grown-ups, they're professionals. Even people on both sides of this thing knew that this is what I do when other organizations get into controversies. And it gives credibility when I'm able to report things. For example, there was the James O'Keefe story that ultimately led to the departure of our CEO in a very short period of time. The tapes that were used to batter Ron Schiller, then the head of fundraising at National Public Radio, and then Vivian Schiller, no relation, then the CEO, both of whom departed in rather short order from NPR. Those videos proved to be unreliable. They proved to have been edited and spliced in a way that was the least flattering possible. So when a website took a critical look at those videos, a conservative website actually owned by Glenn Beck, and then I took a weekend where we were supposed to be in Washington training, with colleagues on the national desk. But I took a weekend with colleagues and with experts in journalism, but also in video editing and manipulation to see how trustworthy were those videos. And they said it was deeply misleading. Having done the stories about NPR's steps and missteps, it gave credibility when I was able to say to this strong critic of NPR that the videos that he had presented to the world on which some of these decisions had been made, while showing at times things damningly said by NPR's fundraising officials, many of those, much of those things had been said in a very different context than had been presented to the public.
How well do you see, David, other news organizations, especially big mainstream organizations, covering their own mistakes? For example, the New York Times and its reporting leading up to the Iraq War, sort of beating the drum for Saddam's going to get us with weapons that were never found. How well do you see other mainline organizations covering their fault, their mess ups?
Well, a couple things come to mind. First, if you think about WMDs, I think that was really the moment at which the liberal and left in this country joined their conservative counterparts in distrusting the media. I think it started in 2000 in the aftermath of those disputed elections where people on the left felt that Al Gore's victory had been taken away from him. I think similarly, in the lead up to the war, the drumbeat of coverage about weapons of mass destruction, the muffling of voices that were dissonant but were credible by the New York Times and Judith Miller in particular, the Times fell down on that. And it took a while for the Times to come to terms with that. Bill Keller came in after the Jason Blair scandal, another big blow.
Scandal of
plagiarism and fabrication,
years back now, right?
2003. Bill Keller came and rose after that. He didn't want to revisit that time. He didn't want to go back and look what had happened under his predecessor. He thought that who had been a rival of his, he thought that would be perceived as him piling on. Well, in reality, what it was that the Times was delayed in keeping faith with readers, keeping faith with subscribers to say, we take seriously the flaws of others. We take seriously the flaws of our own. That said, they did a masterful job on the Jason Blair thing when they finally did it. They did, one could say maybe a B for their coverage after the fact, coming to terms with their coverage of weapons of mass destruction. But the Times did do a mea culpa of sorts. 60 Minutes' Leslie Stahl came out with a mea culpa for her similar coverage. And the Washington Post's Howard Kurtz did some coverage of that. When I was a very young reporter in the early 90s, my mother actually used to send me articles from the Los Angeles Times from California by a guy named David Shaw, who died some years ago. He was the LA Times' media critic. And he would write these sprawling stories that would stretch over pages that would examine not just journalism but the LA Times' role. And some of the things he did, for example, in the wake of the Rodney King riots and the tension between African Americans and other minorities with the police department were masterful stories about how the LA Times had essentially enabled and covered for the police department for decades and had had an incestuous relationship that had built up over years. And that was the case of a news organization being confident of enough of its own standing to be able to say we can take hits to our own reputation because we think it ultimately adds to our record and our luster. I think it's important for media organizations not to be self-congratulatory, not to be self-obsessed, not to be wearing a hair shirt and flagellating themselves. But, you know, these institutions need scrutiny. And if we don't do it to ourselves fairly, it's hard to do it to others.
Well, and someone else is going to do it.
That's
right. Given the proliferation of observers and
that's right.
Websites and so forth.
I mean, you used to hear, I think it was Tom Brokaw who would say, you know, don't expect us to break all the stories about defense contracting woes and General Electric at a time when General Electric owns NBC. And this was some decades ago. It was a little flip, you know, when Slate was founded and started with major investment from Microsoft.
You know, the notion was, well, you can probably find coverage of Microsoft and antitrust concerns in the mid-90s in other places. But I think for major news outlets that claim to be comprehensively covering things, there needs to be a forum and a way of transparent coverage and self-criticism. There are so many players now, there are going to be no lack of critics. One of the things that I think happens to media criticism and coverage a lot of the time is that it becomes a political football in a way to just provide more grist for the cable news yap fests.
The yap fests.
Sure.
What about that corporate ownership, David? There's been a lot written, but I wonder what you think about how increasingly corporate owners buy news outlets don't really care so much about the quality of the news, but more about, you know, making a little bit more to add to the bottom line. There's been a lot written about that, but I wonder if you think it's as bad as it is often portrayed.
It can be pretty bad. I mean, I'd say it's a three decades or more trend going back to, call it the late 70s, early 80s, where the idea was as the stock market really started to rise in a more geometric rather than flatline arithmetic pattern that there's money to be made here. You know, the news business is very much a business. And for corporate owners, publicly traded companies in particular, there was pressure on for them to continue stock growth. If you look at a company like Gannett, you know, it created something new with USA Today in the 80s. And I think it's been an addition and it's improved a lot from the early days when it was criticized as McPaper, just some sort of fast food, you know, thinly sourced publication. But that said, they starved a lot of very honorable local papers, I think, in Rochester, New York, in Des Moines, Iowa, in Louisville, Kentucky, where my wife's from. You know, those papers were once very proud, very strong, and they're pretty anemic these days by comparison to what they were. And the problem is there aren't other larger major news organizations filling the gaps there to the same degree. And I think that's a problem. I think you can point to Gannett. I think McClatchy is a news organization. It took over Knight Ridder, which had a very proud history. But Knight Ridder had had years of seeking to prop up profits by cutting back deeply. McClatchy has had to cut back in ways that I don't think corporately it had hoped to do because of pressure on it from share prices. And I think the fate of the Knight Ridder company was an example of it being unable to satiate some major shareholders' desires to keep that stock price up. And ultimately, it went out of business and had to sell out. So I think there have been some real issues about profits. I think that corporate executives at the very top levels, if you look at a recent column by David Carr of the New York Times, but this is publicly known, they have shared in the abundance and wealth and riches enjoyed by senior corporate executives in other industries as well. So even as they've at times chastised Wall Street executives for seemingly looting the finances of others, they themselves have received, you know, major, call it eight-figure compensation packages at a time where people are being laid off. Well, and I think that's a very tough contrast to stomach for a lot of journalists.
Well, and it's one of the essays in your book talks about that uncomfortable amalgam of a business model, a profit-making enterprise, while news is, to some extent, a public service.
News is very much at its best a public service and a public good. And the reason that you're seeing a proliferation of a lot of not-for-profits now trying to test things out is that there's the question of whether public goods should be treated as a utility that needs to be supported in very much. Actually, people look to the public radio model, to places like New Hampshire Public Radio, because things that propped up news in the past don't exist. So, for example, the decoupling of car advertisements from newspapers. Well, people can go to cars.com. You go to monster.com for jobs. You don't have to look in the Help Wanted section of the Concord Monitor.
Huge source of money, those classified
ads. Huge source
ads.
Of money. Real estate ads, you go directly to their sites, and some of the real estate sites are beautiful and comprehensive. Now, the New York Times in New York actually has a fantastic real estate website, so a lot of people still use it. But in a lot of communities and a lot of major urban areas around the country, this decoupling of income from news organizations has meant that they have to figure out what they're doing, how they get people to stick around. And it's not clear. It's very clear that there is not the financial model currently to support journalism as it was done. And the question is, how can you marry public service, watchdog journalism, accountability reporting with support from what's left over from the advertising and subscription model?
Right. Those checks are no longer rolling in. So how do we support this investigative journalism? Somebody asked you about that at the event last night. And you talked, David, about the emergence of some new collaborations, new ways of doing business. that might save this high-quality, investigative, fact-based journalism. Just give us some examples of what you're seeing out there.
Well, and it's very different in different markets, and it's very different in the local and national scene. But some interesting examples. There's a guy named Walter Robinson. Who had been one of the lead investigative reporters of the Boston Globe here in New England. He had done some reporting, for example, 1999 about then-Governor Bush's military service record and showed that there was basically a year of his time in the National Guard that he couldn't account for anything other than a single dental appointment. CBS then, you know, was brought down Dan Rather's career prematurely ended when he tried to go past that in 2004. But what Walter Robinson had done, you know, years earlier stood up to the test. Robinson's no longer at the Boston Globe. He's at, I believe, Northeastern University. I apologize if I'm misspeaking there, but he's overseeing journalism students in investigative journalist lab and classes. But their reporting at times, done in collaboration with editors at the Boston Globe, appears on the front pages and other parts of the Globe itself. That is a partnership that, you know, it's not that the Globe is exactly outsourcing investigative journalism, but it's collaborating with others outside the walls of its newsroom proper. You are seeing the New York Times form partnerships with not-for-profits in Texas, the Texas Tribune, in Chicago, the Chicago News Collaborative, in the Bay Area as well. And these are run by experienced and smart, innovative journalists and providing them with a greater regional coverage than they could provide on their own.
So the headline, what is it, reports of the news media's death are greatly exaggerated from Mark Twain. That seems to be the case. It's still alive and kicking. It's just emerging and is going to look different than what we know from the past.
A time of great experimentation, a time of great innovation, and a time of deep anxiety, all at the same time.
And going to keep you very busy.
You bet. I hope.
Thanks a lot, David, for coming to New Hampshire and for being with us this morning. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
David Folkenflik, NPR's award-winning media correspondent. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer today is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Ryan Lessard. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.